Accession number 28361, Reel 19.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 19. What happened then after you'd been used as covering Force in Aden? You went to Mazira.
Went to Mazira and did some training, which I think we were talking about before, and there's not much you can do there, but you can do a bit of field firing, you can do a bit of leg stretching, having been locked up in a ship for about a month, I suppose.
Was Bulwark the same as Albion, as far as that was concerned?
Yeah, Bulwark was even worse than Albion.
Oh, was it?
She was the first one, and the accommodation was even worse. She was known as the Rusty Bee. And was even more uncomfortable, as far as the chaps were concerned, at Albion. So having a leg strap was a good idea. And having gone ashore in Missouri, we then had our notice stretched out a bit. The bit of string, the elastic, was stretched even further. So we then went to Gann. And anchored there. We were allowed to go to Gann. We didn't do anything there.
Is there anything out on Gann?
No, there's a huge airfield, which the Air Force, it was a staging post to the Far East, Gann. And we went there, and then we were released and allowed to go back to Singapore. So we then got back, disembarked, and started training. Because that's what you do when there's no operations. So we were in doing fairly low level training when we then did an exercise on the east coast of Malaya, where we landed from Albion this time into an old airstrip on the east coast, and we were carrying out exercises when suddenly we were told, get back on board, sail round to Singapore, pick up any stores that you need, and head off for Aden. Because there's some kind of emergency, the threat level has been raised. So this was in the middle of the night. It's been a night helicopter withdrawal, which is always
exciting.
And of course the adjutant is very much part of it, because you have to organize the withdrawal. I was the last chap off, I think. We then sailed around, flew helicopters ashore to pick up kit that we thought we were going on exercise, so the bits we hadn't taken with us, and then set off for back to Aden. And this time, actually, we sat further off.
How long did it take you to get back to your position offshore?
I think it was about 4 days, 5 days, something like that.
Do you have briefings while you were on the way?
Yes,
about
had,
what was going
we
on?
We had briefings, and the briefings were all, as far as I remember, to the extent that intelligence had been received that there was going to be some kind of coup within Aden, which might bounce off and sort or overflow, as it were, into a situation where the expats would be in danger. Of course, it didn't happen, actually. But we then spent about another 6 weeks off Aden. But this time we were further off.
Yeah.
Not because of the notice, because we didn't want anyone to get an inkling that we were around.
Because if you had to do a rescue mission,
yeah,
it would be best to do it
suddenly.
Without warning.
Without warning, exactly. And we were there with a carrier, as usual. Anyway, that all came to nothing. We then returned to Singapore and got ourselves ready to go on an exercise in Australia, an amphibious exercise, which was going to be in the same area which I'd seen the Aussies do their thing some 18 months previously, or a year previously.
The Queensland area.
The Queensland area. It's a great big training area called, and I can't remember the name of the area, but it's all dry bush. It's a huge area. Hundreds of square miles of training area. Wonderful training area. We did an amphibious landing there. It was a brigade exercise, two commandos, brigade headquarters. The enemy was a Gurkha battalion, and the Gurkha parachute company provided the enemy.
It's a fairly tasty opposition.
Very good. It was a first-class exercise. It was quite a decently long one. It was about 10 days or something like that. quite testing, and the bit I enjoyed actually was right at the end, because my CO had taken off in a helicopter to go off. We were right in the middle of the bush, and he'd taken off in a helicopter to go and look at something, and I had taken the commando to another place, not far away, but there wasn't any way he could land the helicopter. And at that moment, the chap who was running the exercise, who was a very formidable Gurkha general who commanded the 17th Gurkha Division, called Pat Patterson, came through the bush saying, the enemy, which is the Gurkha battalion, is about to advance on and cut the road behind you. What are you going to do about it? So my CO was away. There's no way I could get in touch with him. So I thought, well, this is when I take command. I'm not going to hand it over to a company commander. I'm going to command this push myself. And I looked at the map and decided I'd move the commando about a mile and a half to another blocking position. And so I summoned the company commanders and said, this is what we're going to do. You got, and in about 10 minutes, I had the whole show on the road. And we were marching through the bush and got to it just in the nick of time to beat the Gurkha battalion to the punch. So we were in a blocking position waiting for them when they arrived. So, and that was rather fun, because I found myself, and I was a sort of CO for a few hours.
Did, in effect, then, did they run into a sort of ambush?
They ran into an ambush. They ran into an ambush.
Had you had any inkling that they might be going to do something like that?
Well, not really. You know, this was sort of fed to us by the exercise director as a piece of intelligence, because he wanted a sort of final battle, I think.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I was delighted with that, and my CO was pleased, and so it all ended rather well, and I enjoyed a heady moments, a few hours of command. So that was a good bit of the exercise. We then had a very pleasant 10-day stopover in Brisbane with everybody enjoying themselves, and then headed back to Singapore.
There was no participation by the Australian Army then in these manoeuvres?
No, the Australian Army was at a full stretch in Vietnam. And
but presumably
this is 1968.
Yes, they were having to work up and train for...
Yes, but they were, having done their pass out exercise at the force in the same training area the year before, they were tending to send the battalions to the Canungra training area, which is a different one. And I presumably we'd been allowed to go on this training area because they had no use for it. I mean, they had a gap in the program.
Now, around about this time, government was thinking about running down Far East forces generally, and they were talking about giving up world power status. Government announced we can no longer afford to be a world power, but we will be a power with a worldwide capability. Were you getting vibrations from those political developments?
Yes, we were, because towards the end of my time in Far Elf in the previous job, the planning for the rundown of the Far East was starting. And so I could see it happen. I mean, I didn't get involved in it to any degree, but they were already beginning to talk about what barracks should we give up, what camps should we give up. We weren't going to withdraw from the Far East. That was the plan in 1968. That didn't happen, of course, till 71.
Yeah.
But there was talk of thinning out bits of it, giving up this barracks here, giving up that, and do we need all these ammunition depots? Do we need all these ordnance depots? What can we give up?
That would certainly have implications for you as a logistician
in your
role, because if you're going to have a capability in the Far East
which
is not based upon land, then it means you've got to have more afloat support, really, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Or more air portable.
More air portable stuff. But the stage I left Far Elf, they were only beginning to talk about it, and the sums were starting to be done, and I didn't really get involved in it, but I was aware of it, obviously. And when I then went to regimental duty to the commander, I'd sort of stopped worrying about it. But I suppose at the back of my mind, there was the knowledge that eventually all this was going to end, but we couldn't actually see it over the horizon at that stage. It was out of sight, as it were, over the horizon.
Did you find it easier doing the job of adjutant second time round?
I could do it standing on my head.
Yeah.
no trouble at all.
Mm. But I mean, was it exactly the same as the previous occasion, or did the CEO have a different way of using
it? Well, he had he delegated much more to me.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah. I actually found him an easier chap to work for than my previous couple of CEOs that I'd had. I had two CEOs before, you know, half, one for a year and another one for a year in the previous time. And anyway, life in the Far East was fun and enjoyable. It was a good place to be.
Yeah. And were you able to delegate more yourself down to your assistant adjutant?
Yes. Yeah. I had a very good assistant adjutant. Mm.
So you were really moving up the scale a bit in terms of decision making.
Yes, I was a bit. Mm. I mean, and I was particularly friendly with the company commanders who were more my age.
They're your contemporaries.
They were my contemporaries than the people who'd been in the company commanders the previous time round.
Yeah.
And you know, all our wives were friends, and you know, there was very much a sort of family, and it was a very good place to be. It was a wonderful place to be with your family, Singapore. And one of the reasons I'd wanted to go to regimental duty is I wanted to extend my tour in Singapore. So instead of doing 18 months, I did 3 years.
Mm. Were you able to stay in the same quarters?
I stayed in the same place, yes. Mm. Yes, which was great. Mm. And we had a terrific time. Mm. I was then promoted at the end of the job.
So you had a deployment out to Aden, which was...
Sure.
Nothing happened.
Yeah,
you were there.
Yeah,
you did your big exercise in Queensland, amphibious landing,
yeah,
and then advance inland with the Gurkhas.
Yeah,
playing enemy.
Yeah, so,
were there any other large scale efforts?
No. Because I then that 18 months went very quickly, because I had two Aden deployments. You see, each of about 2 months. Mm. Then there was you know, training and exercises. Mm. And then there was going to Australia. That was about, I mean, that must have taken about 2 months, that whole trip to Australia. By the time we got there, done an exercise.
Done your R&R.
Done our R&R and come back. Perhaps 6 weeks would be better, would be more accurate. Yes. It took us a long time to get there. I mean, it took us 2 weeks to get there. Two weeks to get back. So that's a month before we'd actually sort of done anything, really.
Did you go down there in LSTs or...?
We went in LSLs. Now, LSLs in those days, it's quite interesting, were run by the British Steam Navigation Company, who I alluded to earlier, who'd run the old LSTs. Mm. And they had black funnels with white stripes around them. Mm. And shortly after that, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary took over the running of the LSLs. Mm.
What were the LSLs like? What were the characteristics?
They were very, very good craft. They had been built originally as logistic ships for the army. The army had paid for them out of their money. Mm. And they had bow and stern doors, so they were ro-ros, one of the first ro-ros around, actually. They had very good accommodation. They had very good facilities for loading quickly. They had things called Mexi floats, which they carried on the side, which they could drop, and had huge outboard engines, so they could take loads ashore, which from the ship, either by driving stuff onto the Mexi float off the bow or stern ramp, or plumbing it over the side with a crane. They were very efficiently run, and we found them actually a welcome change from travelling around Grey Funnel Line. Actually, the food was better. And accommodation was considerably better.
So you did assault landings from those?
Yes. When we get to Queensland, what happened was, I mean, some chaps were in the two carriers went out, one in the LPH role, and then HMS Triumph went out to provide another deck.
Yeah.
She was a repair ship, but she went out, so there were two flat tops there. There was a LPD Intrepid, I think, was there. And then there were a stack of LSLs. So what happened was that the how we landed from the LSL was by helicopters coming onto the back deck and taking troops off. the other way that troops were landed, our vehicles were landed, was from the Mexi floats. Right. Mm. And then they went to the beach. And then some of our chaps were transferred to landing craft and landed.
Did the Gurkhas oppose you from the beach?
Oh, yes. Yes, we actually landed inland by helicopter. Mm. We were, I suppose we were about 10, 20 miles inland, something like that. Yeah. Quite a long way inland.
That's considerable depth.
Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, the whole idea was to test this business of using helicopters to
project inland.
To project inland, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
What was the ground like on this exercise?
It was.
You mentioned scrub.
Well, it was dry. It was. Have you ever seen Australian bush?
No.
Well, it's like dry secondary jungle. And of course, it had been cultivated, bits of it. They'd run sheep on it, and there were old sheep stations there. It was completely abandoned. There wasn't anyone there. It had some wonderful names, and there was a wonderful place in the hills which was called Lightney Pipe Gap. It was actually on the map as Lightney Pipe Gap. It's full of snakes, pretty poisonous snakes, kangaroos, and other wildlife. Mm. But it was, I can best describe it as dry secondary jungle. A lot of it was secondary growth, which had grown up after it had been clearance and then been allowed to grow again. And then in other places it was primary growth. Mm. But it was very, very thick, and you couldn't see, when you were in the bush, more than a few yards in any direction. Easy to get lost. The grass was very dry. It was yellow grass. And, of course, the whole thing was like a tinderbox. If it had been a fire, we really would have had a problem. Mm. And that was one of the big hazards we were warned about, was the fire risk.
Did that mean there's a restriction on the use of pyrotechnic?
Yes, I think there was. Mm. I think there was, as far as I remember. Mm. Because, you know, the fire would have gone through that place just like a dose of salt.
But was it flat or was it...
It was hilly. Oh. Not particularly steep hills. Mm. I can't remember the sort of heights they went up to, but it was sort of bumpy country, covered with this bush, and there were occasional open areas which had obviously been fields, which had grown up with this wild grass, and for some reason the bush hadn't seeded there, and the odd track and road, you know, unmetalled. Mud, sandy road through it.
Were you able to do any live firing there?
No. This was a straight two-sided
tactical
exercise. Mm. Yeah, there's no live firing at all.
Mm. And so, effectively, battalion versus battalion.
Well, it was us. Mm. There were two commandos. There was a Gurkha battalion and a Gurkha parachute company.
Ah, right. So it's almost equivalent.
Almost. I mean, they were a sort of battalion and a bit, I suppose, against us. Yeah. Mm.
Was it all conventional?
It was Vietnam.
Ah.
It was Vietnam in Australia against the North Vietnamese Army. Not the Gurkhas weren't trying to pretend to be
guerrillas.
They were a formed body of chaps, and we had fire bases. Ha ha ha.
Ah. Were they simulated artillery bases?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you have any gunners along to play?
Oh, we had guns. The guns were there. Yes. The guns were landed.
So it's effectively the brigade minus one commando.
Brigade minus one commando, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. We didn't have a log regiment in those days. It didn't
you
exist.
Didn't.
And we didn't have a sapper squadron. Mm. That didn't exist then. Mm. So it was a much smaller brigade than it is now.
Mm. But lighter, presumably rather more mobile on foot.
It was mobile on foot. Yes. Everything was everything we took ashore was heliportable. Mm. Yeah. And we had a few vehicles, but you know, the commander headquarters had, I think, two vehicles, mainly with the heavier radios. But other than that, we were on our feet.
So that was a ten day.
About 10 days.
You mentioned the exercise off the east coast of Malaya. What was the idea behind doing
that? Oh, that was a very simple exercise. All it was Albin
landing.
Had just come out to the Far East.
Yes.
And she needed to work up her helicopters.
Oh, right.
And we needed a sort of blow through. Mm. And all we were doing was I think we flew the whole commando ashore. We then did some sort of tactical lifts of companies out to sort of practice the helicopters doing that. It was only going to be a 48-hour exercise, and it ended up by being a 24-hour exercise.
Was it on an exercise area, or was it?
Yes, there was a training area there. And, yeah, I mean, it was a sort of dry training area where you weren't allowed to fire live ammunition or or anything like that.
Presumably, Malaysian army.
I think it was. There was an airstrip there, which was obviously maintained by the Malay forces as probably a sort of diversion airstrip for light aircraft. I mean, it wasn't big enough to take a C-130. It was the sort of thing you could put beavers onto.
Mm. Mm.
But you could certainly land helicopters on it.
So you had your 18 months.
I did 18 months there.
Yes. What happened then?
Then I was posted to be the chief instructor of the officers' training wing at Lympston. Where my boss was Jeremy Moore. So I posted there. And which was a good job. Fun.
Were you happy to go to officer training?
Yeah, I thought that would be a nice thing to do.
What does the chief instructor do? Does he?
Well, the chief instructor was really responsible for the program, and overseeing the other instructors and making certain that the thing was running according to the plan. Also for designing. Making any changes to the course, designing any changes, and there was a move afoot to rejig the whole thing.
I was going to ask you whether it was time to actually make any radical changes.
Well, what had happened was that the previous commandant of the officers' training wing, funnily enough, there were two majors. There was a major as the commandant and a major as the chief instructor, a senior major and a junior major. I was the junior major. The previous chap had got a bee in his bonnet that instead of doing the course in the way that it had always been done, where you did, I think I described it at the beginning, where you did sort of basic training, section training, troop commander training, and then at some stage you did the commando course as a block. That he would spread the commando course through the cake, as it were. So you did your tests at various stages. Well, I thought that was complete nonsense. And they'd already started planning it. In fact, it was going to happen. And I said, this is absolute rubbish. And all the other instructors actually agreed, having been sort of bullied into it by this other chap. And so I had to rejig it and persuade the commandant of the commando training centre, who was the sort of our overall boss, that the thing that he'd approved
shouldn't happen.
So I had to persuade him by proving that it would be better to go back to the other system but change bits of it. And so that I spent a lot of time doing that, rejigging the year's programme in time to stop it happening before the next intake. And so that kept me pretty busy for a bit.
This sounds like it's more administration than... anything else, if you're sorting out timetabling?
Yes, well, it was. I mean, that was very much so, you know, it was not so much that, but it was also making certain that things fitted in, that you weren't trying to teach people to be troop commanders before they'd learned how to fire an SLR. So you had to fit it, and you had to fit it back in, but it also had to fit back into a shorter time. That was the other thing. The training has been cut from 18 months to a year. So
does that mean? I mean, that means either you compress everything or you cut some things out.
Exactly. So that was the other challenge. It wasn't just a question of saying, okay, we'll turn everything back to square one. That would have been easy. We would just say, okay, well, we'll go on with what we've been doing before. And I should have mentioned that because this year training had been, they'd been told you've got to do it in a year. This old commandant thought, well, this is the opportunity to change the whole thing. And let's do this bee in his bonnet, which he had of sort of putting the thing through. And so there was no specific commando course.
What was the reason for cutting the length of training? Was it financial?
Finance. Money.
Nothing to do with quality.
No, it was money. You know, the old pressure, money. Save money.
Now, one thing that occurs to me is if you're doing elements of the commando course all the way through, that means that you can't do your commando course alongside soldiers unless the soldiers' training is also going to be reorganised on the same...
That's exactly one of the reasons that I put forward, that wouldn't happen. And it would also be very sort of episodic. The commando course was something that required a great deal of sort of dedication, motivation and concentration, where now on the commando course, the end of 6 weeks, we're going to get our green berets, not a sort of, you know, where actually doing military law part three this morning, and this afternoon we're going to go and do the speed march, you know. No, that didn't work. Luckily, we managed to change it. But the point was, we had to put a quart into a pint pot.
Yes, at the same time.
At the same time. Mm. And, of course, there were cuts that could be made. There were things that could be taken out.
Mm. What sort of things were sacrificed?
Well, some of the things that were taken out were some of the training on... I'm just trying to remember now that there were some of the things like cutting out some of the model exercises.
The cloth model.
The cloth model exercises, and going straight from classroom instruction to tubes. There was taking out training on some of the weapons that were not troop weapons. In other words, not teaching people GPM, GSF, and waiting that they would then be taught that when they got to their commandos, and not going to do certain things. I can't remember specifically what we did cut out, but we did cut some stuff out.
Was that on your initiative mainly, or was it a matter of consultation with the commandant? And
well, I presented it. He said, okay, the new commandant, Jeremy, arrived, and I said, I'm very unhappy with what we are landed with. And he said, well, actually, so am I, too. Mm. But if you can do it, we'll do it. Mm. So I had to persuade him first. Mm. And then he agreed, and then we took it to the commandant of the CTC.
Mm. And what was his view of it?
Well, he first said, you know, how can you do it? Mm. So we had to talk him through it. It took him took most of a day, I think, to talk him through it.
When you got back there, before you started embarking on these changes of your own, had there been any changes, significant changes, in the officer training since you had done it?
Oh, the biggest change was, if you remember, I said that when we came back from our first tour on a commando, we went on a series of courses all round the place, which were a complete waste of time. Mm. Those had been done away with, I'm happy to say. So that was that was change number one. Mm. change number two was that the officer, having done his year as a troop commander, came back to the officers' wing for a term where they did more what I would call sort of strategic studies. That's perhaps giving it too grand a name, but they started doing more a bit of military history, sort of essay writing, looking at things that were a bit outside the view of a rifle troop commander, really.
Who's teaching that? Was that taught by the instructors?
That was taught by us. That was taught by us. That was taught by us.
So this is going really beyond the troop, into the context of the troop.
Yes, this is going into this is training them to look a bit more widely. Now, for example, we did at that sort of stage. They would do an amphibious exercise, a cloth model amphibious exercise at sort of company and commando level.
Yeah.
So it was sort of widening their horizon a bit.
Was that carried out practically as well as theoretically, or was it all...
No, it was all theory. I mean, you know, unfortunately we couldn't get an amphibious ship and go and do it for real. Mm. And they would then go off and do... They'd then go and visit the landing craft wing and from there. So that term was sort of replacement for something like 18 months worth of dawdling about like we had done.
Mm. So you're centralising the training more then, focusing.
Yeah, we're centralising it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm.
And once you've won your battle about the business of breaking up the commando force into segments and kept it together, did things then run smoothly?
Yes. Mm. I mean, the other objection to breaking the commando course up was the one that you put your finger on. They weren't going to then be able to do it with Marines under training. Mm-hmm. The second one was that they wouldn't even be doing the same course and would be seen to not be doing the same course.
Would they not?
They'd be doing it, but they'd be doing it in sort of segments. Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose of the commando course was to put in the final week, test week, is where you're doing the test each day of the week. So at the end of week five, when you're doing the 30-miler day five, when you're doing the 30-miler across Dartmoor, you've been under pressure for five continuous days. Yeah. And that was the aim of the way the course was run, and therefore to sort of do it like that totally negated the whole purpose.
Yes, it would certainly make any assessment purpose much weaker.
Much weaker, and so a Marine could say, well, you didn't do the bloody command, of course, you sort of did the tests throughout your year. Mm. I mean, if he was that cheeky and wanted to say it, but he might think it. Yeah. No.